They change cultures. They're heat seekers. They run at adversity and embrace change. These are the Room Tilters.
Somebody who can change the temperature in a room when they walk in. Mm. And that's metaphorical for somebody who can influence those around them and make such an impact quickly, emphatically, and long-lasting, whether it be an organization, a team, a relationship, whatever it might be.
This is the Room Tilters podcast, presented by Limitless Minds. Co-hosts DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, founders of peak performance and leadership consulting company, Limitless Minds, explore how the best and brightest change the temperature in a room. From sports, the military, entertainment and media, clinical psychologists to CEOs, this podcast will navigate what it takes to think big and go far. And now, DJ and Harry.
Good morning. We're really excited for this podcast. We have the author, businessman, Wall Street Journal bestselling author, I should say. But for Harry and I, Michael Gale is a friend and a mentor. So good morning, Michael. We're excited to have you on the podcast.
Look, guys, I'm excited to be here. We should have some fun too, because I think all these are really pertinent sort of areas of discussion. And the more expertise you get from the wider range of areas, frankly, the better people are.
That's right. And I know, you know, just from listening to your podcast, and I've really enjoyed our interactions, you know, the time that we've been able to spend over like the last year, but also the podcast, you always talk about what's going to happen in the future. Before we go, you know, 10 years into the future, we'd really like to hear for our listeners a little bit about where you've been and some of the things in your past. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's like a sort of audio resume. So I moved to the States in 93 to Austin. Great small city then. We took a research firm, public, 96, and then went off to run a company called Micron, which is one of the largest DRAM organizations in the world, computer memory. I've had two startups that I've sold, both really handling algorithmic development. How do you build models to predict behaviors? And actually ran a company for Pete Carroll, the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, that focused on mindset training. We took it from a very small embryonic idea over the, you know, the next two or three years to a really big, pretty big company. And now actually, as I said, I'm an author of a Wall Street Journal best-selling book on digital transformation, and I'm about to embark on another book about reimagining capitalism on a flat planet.
Nice. That's awesome. Much of your podcast that I've listened to, and even just talking to you one-on-one and having discussions, you always talk about what's going to happen next and preparing for that. How do you balance that before we get into kind of what you think the future is going to look like?
Oh, I don't have a good view on that.
like a mind reader, or a fortune teller, I should say. But before we go into that, tell me about like how you balance what's happening next with what's happening now.
That's actually a great question. There are a couple, I think there's maybe a pre-question to that, which is why does what's about to happen have more resonance now than ever before? And I think that's important because we're in this really dramatic period of change. And at the corporate level, there is no doubt that that list of Fortune 100 companies or even 50 are going to be radically different in less than 10 years. And in fact, that whole Fortune list will be more transformed in the next 10 years than ever before. The digital revolution we've all undergone, I think major shifts in how we organize ourselves as a society, how we think about environment, you know, green power, food, are really dramatic questions that we are going to have to answer quickly. I mean, this is a crazy number. Mm-hmm. 50 billion chickens are consumed in the US every single year.
Wow.
I'm not even including India, China, right? It's just our consumption of resourcing and our ability to design brilliant answers to it have never had this moment of collision before. We have all the technology in front of us. We have all these, you know, growing flat opportunities in front of us. But I think the reason why that next 10 is really important and how to think about it now is we have a real power to make change organizationally, department-wise, society-wise, and individually. We just haven't had historically. And I think that irrelevant of trying to predict the future, mm-hmm. understanding what we have in front of us right now is, you know, a really important sort of sense of awareness about how you handle choices in ways we've never had historically.
Harry, I think we contributed with as many times as we stop at Chick-fil-A to some of those chickens.
Incredible number, right? It basically means each American eats a chicken every 2 days, right? But it's not just here, right? We know that the vast majority of, you know, carbon footprint is actually created by methane from animals and methane being released from ice. And I just think this ability to actually solve these challenges at a personal and societal level are much more available than ever before.
EJ, I also wouldn't sleep on Popeyes, if I may interject. Popeyes. I don't know if you guys got into the Popeyes Chick-fil-A craze, but it's real.
I'm vegan here, but I do. The idea of chicken is amazing. And I have to say, it's quite incredible how two companies, three basically, have regenerated a desire for chicken sandwiches that was, you know, at best flat to up a little, has now become like, you know, the great gold rush of 1849. It's incredible.
Well, I'm going to really digress here, because when I saw an article where there's a chicken, piece of fried chicken in between two donuts that they're piloting in, I think it's Virginia and Pennsylvania at KFC right now. So Harry, when on your travels today to Virginia, you may try to want to stop into one of those KFCs and grab the donut chicken sandwich.
Send me that link.
It's an interesting illustrator, because part of the desire, it can't just be they've suddenly got chicken to work. It's because people go, you know, I don't really want to eat as much beef anymore. I still like chicken, still like protein. And I think there is this sort of constant shifting process. You know, it's the same with vegan food. There's been piles of vegan choices around for decades, right? Yep. But the whole idea of Impossible Burger or Beyond Meat, it's completely revolutionized the food format. And I just think we have this collision of science and beliefs and values right now that can induce change, whether or not it's a chicken sandwich in donut or one that is, you know, a 400-yard waiting list in L.A., that can induce change that we've just never seen before.
You know, one of the things Harry and I talked about, again, just picking your brain on this podcast, I'm always fascinated with the people or events that have impacted, you know, folks like you, the elite. When you talk about, you know, authors, when you talk about businessmen, what event or individual has impacted you the most in your life?
I think I probably, from a work perspective, and I'm putting my wife aside, when I came over to the States in 93, you guys probably weren't even born, I got here with a bag of clothing because I just thought, why not? I'd seen a front cover of a National Geo. There was no internet then, with a cowboy and a cowgirl. I thought this would be really interesting. So it's really utterly irrational, sort of foolish choice. But the guy, his company I went to, Peter Zandon, it was really, I'd say, like a proxy mentor to me for 10, 15 years. And I just think that it's that mentoring that helps people become the sort of potential best versions of themselves, because it allows them to relax and experience under some stress in ways that others just can't do it for you. And I think mentoring is a vital part of that. So Peter Zandon, who set the first company up that I worked at in the States, was just very wise and thoughtful and extraordinarily self-aware. He knew where his challenges and, you know, issues were. But he gave you the opportunity to relax and become the best version of yourself in the moment. And I think that, to me, is the best form of guidance I ever had. I've met, you know, brilliant people since, Michael Schrag, you know, some people at Microsoft, but they just didn't have that fully rounded mentorship about them that I think is vital for self-development.
You know, it's interesting. I love what you said about about that kind of fully rounded mentorship. And, you know, we talk about, you know, tilting a room on this podcast, and those that have that ability to influence the people around them and really pull them along on the same yellow brick road that they're on potentially. And I think that, you know, room tilters have that ability to mentor in a lot of different ways. It doesn't come in one shape or form, but, you know, I think that for those that are listening that are looking for, you know, growth, it's really the skill set of being able to identify who that person or that entity or that group of people are for you, that can help you, you know, really navigate new terrain. And I think, you know, those people that are able to help you navigate that new terrain, those are room tilters, right? Those are people that can, that you'd gravitate towards. Those are people that can change the temperature in a room as they, you know, as they walk into it. And so that's kind of interesting. I like what you said about that.
And when you think about room tilting, I think there are five skills. These people have perspective or perspectives, right? So they're not afraid to tell you that, because if you don't have an opinion about what the world is, how can you get there? They're extraordinarily good at reflection, good and bad. They are actually up for selling you challenges. They allow you to make errors, minimal errors, and learn from it. And I actually think the other thing is they don't over-celebrate. And that sounds strange, But I think it's too easy to get intoxicated with a moment and not recognize it's part of a journey. So that perspective, reflection, challenge, they allow you to make errors and they don't over-celebrate, I think is a really important set of criteria that if you're looking at people that can tilt a room to mentor you, you should be looking, hey, how do they do against those five criteria? Otherwise, you can either get locked into intellect, locked into charisma, knocked into attractiveness or grumpiness, whatever, and it just becomes a sort of one-dimensional room tilt. And you're looking for something that really changes the axis of the room, not just pushes it to one corner.
I like that. I mean, I think that that one-dimensional room tilt is interesting because, you know, I think most people, when they think about when we describe a room tilter, they are thinking charisma. You mentioned it, and it's so far from that. Certainly, that may be a result or something that you see, but I think how you laid it out is pretty fantastic. You know, I think perspectives and reflection, it's all around like self-awareness and you know, how you think about things there. I think that, you know, obviously we talk about people who run at adversity. You mentioned, you know, challenges being welcomed by these individuals. And I love the, you know, not celebrate, you know, don't over celebrate, right? And I think it's great to celebrate successes in the moment. But I think those individuals that are able to turn the page quickly, whether it's negative or in positive scenarios, those that are able to turn the page tend to, you know, continue to grow because they're not, you know, they're not marinating in their own, you know, success.
Because their own negative juices. Yeah. I mean, like we all know there are very few athletes that have that toilet memory perspective, but I think it's the addition of reflection and perspective and understanding challenge and errors. You can get a very small number of people that can completely re-tilt the axis of a room continually, almost like their own gyroscope. Mm-hmm. And looking for that gyroscope, I think, is a really important skill that we do not teach management or, you know, sub-board level people to look for in their colleagues.
Really, really strong. I think that whole, you know, not over-celebrating, I think that plays into the neutral thinking that we talk about too. Yes. As well. You know, and I know you and Trevor had a recent opportunity to discuss that. So tell us about, you know, how neutral plays a role with you as a leader and give us a glimpse behind the curtain there.
So I think there are two facts that drive the value of neutrality, I think, greater than ever before. I think when things are very consistent, relatively predictable, the act of being positive, it's actually fairly linear. You're either positive or negative because you've got predictable input, predictable output. But I think in a world that is seismically changing, I mean, we saw this in the first book, we're going to see it in the second, you have to be able to sit in a situation and contextually understand what you have in front of you. False signal, positive signal, you know, genuine choices, non-genuine choices. And instead of trying to look over the horizon, you work from moment to moment. And empirically, when we interview leaders in really big global 2000 companies, we went through like 140 variables, asking them about their strategy models, for example, those that said it's always one step ahead, it's not, you know, way over the horizon, but mm-hmm. infinitely more economically successful than companies that talk about very long-term 3-5 year planning. And I think in periods of seismic change, which nobody could argue we're not going through, being able to absorb what's happening to you right now allows you to filter through positive and negative signals far, far more easily than ever before. It's one of the reasons why you can see in athletes that the great ones generally are able to deal with the moment, adapt, adjust, and really comprehend context much better than just good or great players, because they understand that the moment matters. And we talk a lot about this in the book, and Trevor and I talked a lot about it on the podcast for Forbes. Living in that moment, accepting what you have in front of you, and then working through choices is a much more common situation, I think, for anybody in life now than possibly in the preceding 50, 75 years.
No, that's powerful. And that'll be one where I rewind and listen to that again. So thanks for sharing those nuggets. You also just mentioned how errors are welcome. And I love that, because I think that the general public, or, you know, even myself as, you know, when coming up as an aspiring leader, when I first started leading people, you know, I thought I had to be perfect, right? I thought errors were something that, like, you know, if I failed, that was going to be something that, you know, discredited me as a leader. And I'm anxious to hear, how does failure play a role in your success? And is there a situation that stands out for you?
Yeah, I'll give you a sort of base research piece again. In the preceding book, we asked people about experimentation, which has an inherent failure rate. And you ask people their tolerance between, you know, just doing what they do, staying successful within that boundary, or pushing boundaries and actually working through experimentation, frankly, even if it fails. So if you can work through experimentation and it fails or succeeds, but you work through the whole process. In the Global 2000, when we talk to the leaders, there's a 750% more likelihood that your organization is thriving than if you give up on experiments halfway through. 7.5 times more likely chance you succeed. Because in periods of seismic change, you don't know what's going to work or isn't going to work. But if you see experimentation as a learning process, as part of a learning culture, it's amazing how quickly and effectively you can learn from relatively small errors and move on. Amazon is beyond doubt the best example. We forget the cell phone they tried or other stuff. But learning and experimenting and failure are a positive attribute in a modern digital corporate culture. What have I learned from it? I think the last business that we sold, we were lucky, we got a pretty high valuation for it. There was a product we produced, and I was too ready to accept the negativity of others and an inability of others to have a go. And actually, at the end, it probably cost about $150 million because we weren't, as a collective, prepared to experiment properly to find what the right product solution was in a short enough period. And others said, yeah, this peg is square and that hole's round, but we'll jam the edges in. Doesn't work. And I think in a digital world, people are far more aware of when things are bad fits than when they are potentially good fits, and will buy into the idea of something that could be a good fit you experiment to as being a way through it. So I think if a modern successful corporate culture is about a learning culture, being able to experiment and fail inside that is actually a really positive thing. And if you can't accept the latter, you shouldn't pretend to be the former.
Well, yeah, I think that's really interesting, right? Because I think that whether it's business, life, you know, sports, military, whatever it is, I think we'd all agree that the best ideas, the best growth, the most success is usually right on the other side of that failure, that experimentation. Some of the most successful businesses in the world, you know, started looking like one thing, one version of itself, and ended up, or maybe not, they're probably not even finished yet. They're still evolving, but they've changed over the course of time, in some cases quickly. And certainly speed, you know, speed is a good thing, but I think, and bias fraction is great. We really believe in bias fraction, but I think that ability to experiment and take risks that are calculated or based around, you know, experiences and education are really valuable, even in your personal life.
Well, think about the pharmaceutical industry, right? Historically, it makes chemicals. There's no doubt that it's going to get into organ replacement, vascular replacement, monitoring, and a whole bunch of measurement environments, because that's the outcome of this enormous shift in science and application we've seen. So if you want to just stick with what you did 3 to 5 years ago, you've got to question whether or not in 3 to 5 years time you're going to be profitable. And we all know that in life is generally true, from electric cars to healthcare management. And I think the reality is, if you can't accept that change is constant, it's very difficult to be in an organization, or frankly as an individual, develop to be a better version of yourself. You know, what we used to do for television watching 3 years ago is not what we do for television watching now. And that's a pretty trivial variable. So I think helping people develop personal skills that enable them to sort of cope, manage, and thrive in periods of constant, somewhat unpredictable change is part of what these skill set developments are about.
You know, we're talking about different attributes that help people to be able to tilt a room. And I keep hearing you say this word change, you know, change. And what we've seen is that these elite performers often embrace and accept change very well, often look forward to it because they know that a lot of other people will shy away when change happens or be distracted. And that gives them the ability to focus on certain behaviors then that will drive performance. When you look at some of these elite performers and organizations, what behaviors do you see them exemplify?
I can give the empirical response and the research we did, but I'll give you more of an emotional feel, because we spent about 3,000 plus hours with everything from the GSA, you know, the biggest procurement organization in the world, to people like USAA in San Antonio and Hallmark. There were three, to me, indicators of how it worked. Organizationally, they were not pyramids. They were not the I say you do environments. They were, hey, we have a collective challenge. How do we solve a collective challenge? And I think that shift from pyramid to collective challenge, devoid of the organizational structure, is a really big deal. I think the second thing is they are very aware of what's happening in the world around them. And part of that reason is it starts to demystify personal view, and it starts to bring in real context of what's happening in the outside world, whether or not it's people's home lives or market shifts or challenges that sales have. And the third issue is they are confident enough that they can handle every single possible situation because the collective is mutually responsible to each other. And to be mutually responsible to each other, people need to understand how they can react in these situations, how they can mutually accept external information, new challenges, and sort of personal interaction. And that form of agility is really what an agile digital organization and frankly society should look like. But boy, it's really tough to do. We tracked about 28% of major corporations can do it. And those that can't are so calcified in their process. I worry about their capacity to even thrive, let alone survive in the next 3 to 5 years.
I love that agility piece that you mentioned. And I've heard you talk about that offline with us too, as well, just to be able to adapt to change, not only know that change is coming and be able to embrace it, but to adapt to it. That's where that agility comes into play. So we've got some really good pieces of information around what tilts a room. Tell me about a time where, like, you've seen either yourself, because you're a room tilter, obviously we've identified that, or even you've been around somebody else that is attempting to influence and have that significant influence, but they're doing a couple of things that are preventing them from tilting a room. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Look, room tilting is available to everybody, right? And I could spend 5 weeks telling you every single occasion I failed, because I'm much more aware of where I failed, frankly, than a few occasions of success. But I think what tends to cause a problem when people fail is they don't recognize the moment and the power of that moment to make a difference. So imagine you're sitting in a planning meeting, or you're in a sales meeting or marketing, whatever it is. You've got to be adequately self-aware that something's going wrong or is underperforming in the room. You know, it's maybe a 40, 45 minute meeting, and there may only be a 5 minute section where it's gone wrong. But that capacity to lean into that moment is absolutely vital. It requires a level of confidence. It requires a level of comprehension about where you're weak and strong. You've got to sort of do some mind practice before it comes out. You have to recognize that words, body, actions can be really powerful in limited periods of time, because that's really how the world happens. You know, not every moment in 24 hours is going to be incredibly important, but there are moments that occur where you need to be able to react in the correct way to them, because it can affect the renavigation of it. And I think to potentially room tilt is as much about your capacity to understand the moment and the context as it is around your skills of articulation, leadership, you know, storytelling. And people mostly fail because they don't generate that gut feel of, hold it, how do I accept what the situation is and then react to it? They tend to premeditate actions. It's sort of like in baseball, you know, a batter just deciding what the swing's going to be even before he's seen where the ball is. You're just not going to be that successful with it. So I think understanding that there's maybe a second, half a second, or 1 second to just make that decision is really vital at work, personally, a whole bunch of other stuff like that. And I think that's a critical part of being a sort of gyroscope in a room, not just being able to lean it one way or the other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I guess, you know, my question would be, how do you build that skill?
Outrageous failure. So I'll give you my very first business meeting I ever went to. It was to see the chairman of Digital Computers. Company doesn't exist anymore, right? I was so nervous. I literally spent 3 days practicing, and all I had to do was to ask, how much time do we have for a meeting today? That was it, right? So 15 minutes into me asking how much time we had a meeting for today, it was just a complete fiasco, right? I learned very quickly about how easy it is for things just to unravel right in front of your face. And I think you have to have a calamitous learning experience like that to start recognizing the moment, right? You know, I was 23, 24-year-old, and it was such a simple task. How long do we have for a meeting today? It's really easy just to wind yourself up to the point where you induce failure, because you lose that sensitivity to the environment around you.
That's awesome. I really like that, because, you know, thinking about it too, you know, as going back to a young leader, all the insecurities and how you would play and actually use visualization in the wrong way at those times, right? You know, and your insecurities get the best of you. And even something as simple as just, you know, saying two or three words can become this big you know, catastrophic type of thing. So
I mean, literally, I didn't know how much time I spent doing it. And the guy left the room and said, Michael, that was about 18 minutes, right? You just spent asking him how much time you have for the meeting. I'm like, oh my God, sorry. Humiliation can be really good if it's a good learning moment.
That's right. That's right. Well, this is great. I think you have given so many awesome pieces of advice here. Usually, typically at the end, we like to do a call to action. Is there one thing, one piece of information that you'd like to leave with the listeners before we go into the quick fire questions?
I think if you want to be capable of tilting a room, and look, I think everybody has it in them at various times. Think about those five elements. You know, do you have a perspective? Because if you can't tilt a room unless you have a perspective. Are you able to reflect, good and bad? Because if you can't reflect, you don't know how to sort of do that careful foot adjustment as the room tilts. Are you up for challenges? Because, you know, perspective and reflection without challenge is sort of like a film critic. It's sort of sitting on the side, not prepared to engage. You've got to be prepared to make errors. You are never, sort of like playing Madden, you're not going to get good unless you get to the professional level. You're never really going to get a joy out of it till you're up for challenges. And I think you cannot over celebrate a preceding moment because you'll miss the next one. And I think that's part of that sort of room tilting mentality, is to have those three variables, the five variables: perspective, reflection, capacity to want to have be challenged, you know, be okay with errors and not over celebrate. And I think that's a simple write on a piece of paper and stick it on your computer and carry it around with you at every meeting, because you might be pleasantly surprised at how many rooms you can tilt in a day.
I love it. You know what? And don't write it on a piece of paper. You have to do it like Michael Gale, and you have to write it on a napkin.
And we have every napkin for every business we've sold. It's very bizarre. My wife keeps them in a filing cabinet. But I realize right now it's an important measure. We've also had three or four napkins that were disasters. But
right? You know what? It's funny because, I mean, you'll even when we're talking and you're giving advice, I love when you text over the picture of the napkin that you wrote on. So that's something that I admire about you, and it makes you unique. So thanks again.
Of course.
It's good stuff. So now we'll get into the quick fire questions. And what's the last book that you read?
I'm actually in the process of reading five at the same time, because I think part of writing a new one, you just have to do it. So here are the five books right now, and I really love them. One is a book called Loon Shots by Safi Bacall, and it talks about the sort of strange coincidences necessary to make things highly successful. The next book is Late Bloomers by Rich Colgard. He's a publisher at Forbes. It's a really elegant dissertation, really, about why we dismiss older people in society when in fact they could be unbelievably powerful. Mm-hmm. The third book actually is Stephen Fry's book, an English comedian. It's about heroes. And it's just a really interesting discussion about heroes and their dark sides. Mm-hmm. The next book is by Yuval Noah Harari, which is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. It's a really great book. And the last one is actually Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink, who is one of those remarkable SEALs. But it talks about leadership under incredible duress. And I think it's a superb sort of 4 or 5 hour read. And it's really worth it for a Sunday afternoon as a book to look at.
That's great. Harry, have we ever had anybody with five books that they're reading at the same time? I love it, right?
No, I mean, like if I'm doing an audio book or like a, you know, like a blink list, maybe I'll do five at a time because I can read them in 8 minutes or listen to them.
that's a quick tip. If you want to be great, you know, read some books, five of them a month. So I love it. What's your favorite place to travel?
Home. Not a read, because I don't mind traveling, but I love home life. I love my wife. We have dogs. We live in a beautiful place. The act of traveling home makes me feel warm on the inside.
That's cool. That's awesome. And when you come to Cleveland, it feels like home when Laura's, you know, doing her thing here.
Yeah, Cleveland's a cool place.
That's good. So are you a ski vacation or beach guy?
If my wife had to sit on a beach for more than 30 seconds, she'd kill people. Every holiday we've ever taken anywhere in the world has to be active by definition. If it's not active, we're in trouble.
Okay, good. What's your hidden talent?
I always wanted to be a newscaster, I think, and I'd actually gone through training at college to do some of it at Cambridge. I still actually think I'm pretty good at it, but I'll never get a chance to do it. So I'd argue I end up doing news commentary in the car. That's sort of like singing in the shower.
I think the podcast thing is very similar to a newscaster. I think you do a
fantastic. It's as close as I'm going to get, but I'm never going to be able to say, good evening, this is London. It's 8:30, GMT, and here's the news. It'll never happen, so I deal with that.
Well, Harry's really jealous of your voice and accent, so he.
I'm sure you can buy them online now. Everything's available. So
no, I mean, if I had your accent and while being a black guy, I'd feel bad for Courtney because it would just be like this influx of just people trying to court me and.
But just imagine, you'd be like Idris Elba, right? You'd be the most popular actor in the world. You could do any role you want just by turning and say, look, why wouldn't you want this, right?
I mean, I'd be a younger Idris Elba, and what's better than that right now?
basically, the outrageousness that he's not James Bond is even more important, but you're absolutely right. It's the ultimate role model, intellectually, physically, voice-wise. It's like perfect.
So, favorite band or musician, dead or alive?
It's a tough one. Give me a second, because it's a difficult.
I struggle with this too. Still,
because to me, music is about emotion, right? And you know, at one level, you know, you think about everything from Motown, you go, "Oh, I can't just ignore that."
That's right.
And you think about classical music, you're like, "I can't just ignore that." So I'll tell you, this week actually, we went to see Bon Iver in Portland. He was unbelievable. So I'm going to say Bon Iver, because just this week, that's the music I can't stop listening to.
Okay. All right. Or you could say Barry Gordy and just cover the whole Motown thing.
Yeah, but he didn't record anything, because that's like a delicious, that's a double cheat, isn't it?
So, well, this has been a real pleasure, Michael. We really appreciate the relationship and friendship that we've been able to build here. And I'm glad we got to capture it on a podcast. So thank you again for your time. And we look forward to the next time we get to interact and meet. So.
Yeah, so look, guys, continue tilting rooms, because it's remarkable stuff you guys are doing and it's really powerful. So thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to the Room Tilters podcast, hosted by DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, presented by Limitless Minds.